we walked through the stages of grief. And she said, okay, first thing to know is these aren't sequential. Each one is a different thing that addresses a different need, and they'll come and go, and they won't go in order. There's no end to them. We all grieved in our own way, and then we started trying to make plans for a funeral.
Welcome to another episode of Relentlessly Resilient, where real people share real life experiences and the tools they've developed to move forward and live their best lives. I'm Jenny Taylor.
And I'm Michelle Scharf. Jenny, finally, our guest today. Oh my gosh.
We have been waiting
for a very long time.
Yeah.
So I met Aaron Preston through politics. Aaron is an amazing attorney. She has done amazing work in our community to support families and represent them to school districts, whatnot. She has helped me with my kids when they were younger. I've known her for a very long time, and helped me with IEPs, which is the individual education plan for my kids when they were struggling in school and negotiating with teachers and whatnot. She's just been an amazing friend, a longtime friend. And the reason that you and I, have both wanted her on the show for a long, long time is that in 2018, when we both lost our husbands, 6 weeks before John passed away, Aaron's husband died. And it was sudden and it was shocking. I'm going to start crying. And I remember thinking, as I knew that my husband's day was drawing near, I remember going onto Facebook and seeing what had happened, and I was breathless. I just thought, you know, I knew that this was coming, but for her to have this happen so suddenly, and it felt paralyzing to me. I didn't know how to reach out. I didn't know what should be said or done. And I was also just so terrified because I knew that my day was approaching quicker and quicker. Yeah. Aaron, welcome to our show.
Thank you. And I'm so happy to be here with both of you guys. I listen to your podcast and I kind of feel like we're all trauma bonded, and I'll sometimes make comments.
Trauma bonded.
Yeah. I'll make comments on top of your comments as if you can hear me in your ear or something. I don't know.
You should call me and say, I just listened to this. This is what I was thinking. And be like, oh my gosh, I know. I didn't have time to go there.
Yeah. Well, as you talk about your own experiences, yeah, I have so many moments of, yes, it was exactly like that. Or, oh, that was different for me.
Yeah.
Or, oh, this is what happened to your children. And I'm an education attorney. I'm a former administrator. And so I deal with students and kids. I have a bunch myself. And so going through all this with my kids and then prior things and after things, how to deal with death has become something that was a gift I never wanted to be given, but that I have been able to hopefully use for others' benefit.
Yeah. The other thing that's really, and why we've waited so long, is unlike Jenny and I, you didn't have just one loss that year. And nobody ever has one story. We say that all the time, sure, Jenny, on our show, yeah, right?
It's not one and done.
It's not one, yeah, and done. We all have a lot of traumas that we go through, a lot of challenges, a lot of hard, hard things that
but
we deal with.
Not usually all in succession.
Right.
Yeah.
Not usually all so one on top of the other. So yeah, share with our listeners your story.
I'll just share 2018.
Yeah, 2018.
Okay.
Right.
We're going to zero in. Can you believe it's been 5 years?
The story you came on to share.
Yeah. Some days I feel like it was yesterday, and some, yeah, days I feel like it was another lifetime ago, and then they merge.
Yep.
And they just weave in and out of each other, like other parts of my life, like other losses that I've had. By way of intro, I'm a farm kid from Idaho, grew up on a ranch, raised in large part by my World War II era grandparents and my great-grandma, who was a Prairie Schoolhouse teacher.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
I have all these connections to different generations, grew up around aunts, uncles, cousins. I'm the oldest cousin. And early experiences with death were, you know, losing my great-grandma when I was 12. She was wonderful and canning peaches until the day she died. But it was her time to go. She was 92. And then eventually my grandparents and as much as possible, everybody passed away on the farm. But then there were some deaths that shouldn't have happened. There was a cousin of mine who, beautiful, wonderful, amazing young girl who at 14 shot herself for something I think was a little bit of a harbinger of something we see in our society now. Toxic perfectionism. Oh. Straight A student, beautiful, popular, well-loved by everybody, better at just about everything than everyone, but she was so hard on herself. And there's a lot to that, but she shot herself when she was 14, and that was my first experience with really traumatic death.
Trauma.
And how it can impact a family. Our family, the large family, still bears the scars. Her parents and siblings have never recovered. And so that was something that's always been sitting in the back of my mind. You know, it was horrible. It was a loss. I fast forward to end of 2017, beginning of 2018. And one of my sons, who was going to Harriman High at the time, was talking about how he was having trouble focusing in class. And I'm like, okay, we've all got ADD, you know, think in 15-minute chunks, do these things to keep your attention. And he's like, no, Mom, they're just announcing kids who have committed suicide over the loudspeaker like it's nothing. And I had been a school administrator at this time. I had gone back into practicing education law. And I thought, this can't be right. And I started asking more questions. And I had already been to the funerals of two of my former students, but I didn't realize that they were part of a much bigger picture. And so I had collected five names of students who had committed suicide from Harriman High that year. And I'm not one to be shy or keep my mouth shut, especially when it comes to anything involving kids. And so I went to the Jordan board meeting, and during public comment, I said, you have a suicide contagion that's beginning at Harriman High. And the PR person who was there said, no, we don't. And somebody else from administration said, no, we don't. And I said, look, I've got five names. And I said, it's happening. And if I were you, or if I were the administrator over this, I would do these things as taken from a website for public school counselors. I said, and if I was not willing and able to do those things, I would resign before I had another kid's blood on my hands, which was a little bit graphic at the time. But these were not pretty deaths, and these were not anticipated deaths. Anyway, the next month I went back because there had been more deaths and nothing had been done. And, you know, I had some information from my son who was one of those hurting, but I also had begun to realize these weren't connected. The kids didn't know each other. The kids were from all walks of life, upper class, middle class, lower income, single parent families, nuclear families, religious, not religious. There was no commonality and they didn't know each other. And so I had been watching this and watching this. And my experience with Trenna when I was young was screaming in my ear of, you have to do something. And my son had actually gone in to try and speak to the principal, and he had not been receptive of my son's recommendation that he get out in the hall and speak to kids more. They just needed to feel loved is the theme. Anyway, second time I went and talked, I said, what you denied before, we're now up to seven names. And you have to do something. And then to the board members, not in public, I said, I'm an education lawyer. I'm breaking my contract with Jordan, which was in place. I wasn't the primary attorney. I was a as-needed attorney. Broke the contract with them and said, I'll take the case of the next kid who attempts or commits suicide because you've been warned and you're doing nothing. And I didn't know how else to do something. Around the same time, I started talking to a counselor in our area. Her name is Kendall Marcroft. She's very out there, and she was seeing the same things I was seeing. And we started talking and trying to figure out, okay, what comes next? Because the school district really wasn't doing anything and more students were dying. And my public speaking made the Tribune and the Des News, and a national news source actually picked up the story and was looking at it from a social perspective of why here, why now, why so many? And then it got bigger and bigger. Eventually, at the end of the school year, they changed principals to a wonderful principal who's still there now, who is out in the hall every passing period. He's there before the kids get here. He's there anytime the kids are out in the hallways. He's talking to the teachers all the time. He did the right thing. His name's Principal Todd Kornberg. And in the following year, he changed everything along with a lot of other resources given. This is when the State Office of Education first formed a, I guess it's called a strike team, when they sent in counselors and such into this school, because at that point, the counselors at the school were also melting down. And the teachers were traumatized, as one teacher put it, how did you think it is for us to see an empty chair? But through all this, I had a wonderful husband, Brian Thatcher. I always went by Preston, he always went by Thatcher. We had each been married before, and we'll call those not good marriages. And when we found each other, it was just so good. There was just unquestionable love. And more than anything, he always had my back. And I always felt stronger with him at my back. And so going through this and so many other things, and we went through things together. We went through things as a family. We talked about all of this with the kids. That was still going until, well, Brian died on June 28th of 2018. And at that point, others had to take the lead on what was happening in Harriman with the kids. I was too gutted. Maybe I'll switch over to talking about Brian for a minute if I could.
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
He was almost a bigger than life fellow. He was a fireman, had been state fire marshal. He had this huge ability to love. He gave the best hugs in the world. I've never had a hug as good as a Brian hug. And he would give hugs to people that I didn't think wanted the hugs. I asked him about it one time, and he said if they don't want a hug, then they need it even more. And he was just this big bear of a man who would do that. He just loved. He was also a fire marshal who investigated arson and other things, and he had the ability to arrest people. He could be quite tough and quite intimidating. And so that was the duality of him. But when he turned off that tough guy thing when he came home, he brought the fun. We were very happy. We had a good life with his kids and my kids. We each effectively had sole custody of our kids, and we formed the blended family, and which, no small task, by the way.
It can be an episode of its own, I'm sure.
Never yeah. is.
It yeah, is, actually. Absolutely. Throw in a foster daughter along the way, and, you know, we had our challenges, but there was always laughter. There was always love. There was always teasing. To quote a Brianism, if you're the person in the firehouse who isn't getting made fun of, you're the jerk. Or asshole is how he would say it. But it was a good theme because we teased each other, but in a loving way. Anyway, wonderful, wonderful, happy, happy years. He found me, on a construction site. I was overseeing construction on a school, and he heard me laughing at something during construction. He claims he fell in love. Then I think it's probably a line, but he stuck with it.
I think it's probably true then.
Maybe.
Love at first laugh.
You know, you said the date that he passed was June 28th. That was just 20 days before John died. But isn't that funny how grief does that to you?
Time becomes a different thing.
Yeah, altogether. Like in my mind, it was had to be like 6 weeks, I was thinking. But it was only 20 days before.
No, I actually have my list of dates here because I wanted to make sure that I was remembering them correctly.
Yeah. Wow.
Brian was 44, in good health. He had
so young.
Passed a physical the week before, frequent mountain biker and snowboarder. And
he was the fire chief, right?
He had been deputy state fire marshal, which is kind of a big deal position. Then he had been fire marshal over the University of Utah hospitals. And at the time he passed, he was the Draper fire marshal. They okay. just formed the Draper fire department, and he took the job wanting to be closer to home and not spend so much time away from us. And yeah, they were just forming the new fire department, and he was thrilled to get to be back in a firehouse and, you know, joshing with all the guys and eating meat and not eating the vegetables I made him eat and such. Anyway, he was very happy. It was honestly the happiest we had been in our lives. We had already gone through some really hard things with politics, with our jobs, with other things, but we had had each other's back. And like he always told me, you're tougher than you think you are. And that was a theme. He was making me into somebody who was stronger than I had ever been before. And I hope I was doing the same for him. The night of June 28th, I was dropping off one of our kids for a high school jazz concert. And when I went to leave, he said, wait, just stop. And I'm like, Brian, I'm late. I was always late. And he said, just wait a second. And he came up and he gave me one of his huge bear hugs and a big kiss and said, just know I can't wait to grow old with you. Love you. And I left. When I came back home, he had collapsed on the kitchen floor, and I immediately started CPR, and I broke some of his ribs. I'm proud of that, but he didn't come back. I called the EMTs. While I called the EMTs, I had a neighbor who's a dear friend come over. He had been a policeman, and Robert Kirby, who was a next-door neighbor and a good friend of both of us. Robert's a former policeman, and Brian, of course, is a firefighter, and so they would always tease. Those two groups don't always get along.
The banter, sure.
Yeah. You know, Brian would be driving down the street, and Robert would yell out, go get a cat out of a tree, why don't you? You know, that kind of stuff. But they had actually bonded at one point when, you know, they were taking a shared load of junk to the dump, and they both simultaneously said, I wonder how many bodies are buried out here. And so they bonded at that
point. They just knew they had a connection.
Well, they had both done murder investigations and such. Anyway, so they had become good friends, but I didn't know who else to call. I called him. He came over and he told me what the EMTs were doing. He told me how long they'd go and all the specifics of what they were doing. And I was just yelling at him. Brian, come back. Brian, you're stronger than this. And eventually they called time of death. And Kirby was there. I think he couldn't take anymore, and he left at that point in time. But in the meantime, Chief Clint Smith, who is the Draper fire chief, had come over along with another one of the chiefs, and they had heard the 911 come out, and they realized it was Brian, and they had come over to the house, and so they were there for me. And in fact, Chief Smith, so Brian passed somewhere between 6:30 and 7 that night, and Chief Smith stood at the front door until they took the body out at 2:30 so that I wouldn't be alone. Never sat down anything. But those who wear the badge. At first, just I was in total shock. And then, like, I have to call the kids. So that was one night where all the kids were somewhere else. And so I started calling where they were and said, you have to come home. And Brian's dead. And, you know, he's 44. He's their dad. He's been their stepdad. And it's unimaginable that that huge personality and that huge flame could be put out just like that. And I don't remember most of the reactions. I was just on autopilot, and I was upstairs and they were all downstairs. And because of what Brian did, they were initially investigating it as a murder and wanted me to stay away. And I just so wanted to be near him and next to him. And anyway, and so I called the people who I could think to call, and I couldn't tell you right now who all they were, of course, all the kids. And a couple of neighbors came over who had seen the sirens and the lights, and they kept asking me, do you have any relatives who are nearby? And I couldn't think of anything. I couldn't think of anyone. And then finally I'm like, my sister lives in Springville. And I gave them her number, and they called her. I'm the oldest of five kids. She's 18 months younger than me. She and her husband, Brad, drove up. Her vision isn't great. He was right there with her. They came, and Brad stood next to the door too for the entirety of this. And we were all in shock. Of course, the kids came over, and it was vacillating between just shock and horror, but also there were funny things. And that's an element of me and my family's story, is dark humor. We began going to dark humor pretty early. One of the funniest things I can't tell you on air, but it was something Brian had promised my youngest son. But another thing, I kept pressing for us to go be able to see him, because this is a tradition in my family. We say goodbye to the body. We say goodbye to them. And, you know, I had crawled in bed with my grandma when she was passing. And, you know, you just, mm-hmm. you're there. And the police wouldn't let us go down. And then Chief Smith, bless his heart, said, let them go down. And so me and my boys, that was all who was there then. We went down and said our goodbyes to his body, and you could feel it. You could feel him there, along with a really obnoxious police detective who kept saying, I wouldn't want my kids to see this. I think you're making a mistake. I'm like, just shut up. Just shut up. You don't know. You don't know.
Yeah. You know, everybody handles grief so differently, and we all have cultural or familial ideas about how to handle grief. It's really individual. So I think I would have been so upset to hear someone tell me how I should have been doing what, you know?
I was upset. I was trying to retain some dignity. And I said, you don't know us. You don't know my family. This right. is, we're with the person when they go. And this body isn't just a shell. And
yeah,
he kept going, but it was this big reminder of, this is weird for people. And the biggest reminder was, death has to be avoided. You know, stay away from death. Stay away from anybody who has seen death, felt death, anything like that. And that's not how I was raised. Death was the other end of giving birth. And I can't say it's as beautiful, but it can be as profound. And in that, I just had to be with him. I had to lay down next to him on the floor. And anyway, so we came up, and one of the funny ones is my youngest said, why was Brian's belly so big? He'd been covered by a blanket at that point. And I said, oh, he's been sucking it in for 7 years. Didn't you know it? We all laughed, and it began a long litany of, when you just cried all the tears that are left.
There's nothing more to do but laugh.
You have to laugh. You have to laugh. And sometimes the laughs are ridiculous. Anyway, the aftermath. Yeah, it was so quick. It was so quick. I wasn't prepared. He was busy. I was busy. But suddenly he was dead and nothing mattered. And I couldn't get a sense of up or down. And the third sister, who's 2 years younger than the second sister, her name is Terry. She and her husband had been very close to Brian. We were all very close. And she got in her car and she drove all night and came out, and she kind of became my body man, for, you know, to use a semi-political term. She was one who always understood me, and she just kept people away from me while I laid there and cried for days. And I was raised Mormon, but we were not really a religious family. And so my sons, all our sons, learned at that time what the Relief Society is, and that's the people who bring food when somebody dies. So one of my sons was telling me last night why he likes a particular dish so much, and he's like, because the Relief Society kept bringing it over after Brian died. Anyway, so a lot of people stepped in. My sister was keeping me from people because I couldn't handle, he's in a better place. I couldn't handle, oh, I understand. I couldn't handle, oh, I know just how you feel. And I didn't want to be mean, but I couldn't understand how I felt. How could I?
How could somebody else on the outside?
Right, right. And then, you know, over the weeks, oh, well, you know, my dog died, or, oh, my grandma died once, or well-intended people giving the depth of what they had to give on that front, but it didn't help. It didn't help. Whereas other people came out with great depth, and I learned things about people I had never known. And it changed my relationships for life. So I tried to get through that. We all tried to get through that. The first thing that I want to share, because I think it's really important, is we got all the kids together the next day, or I did. Yeah. Attrition made me the last parent standing at that point, and Kendall Marcroft, who had come over that night, and she said, can I come over the next morning? And we were all together, and we did, and she sat us down at the table, and in a very matter-of-fact way, she had us each touch what part of our body was hurting the most at that point. And for me, it was like my chest. I couldn't catch a breath. I just felt like my heart was going to break at all different times. And others, it was the head or the stomach, and it was different. And then we walked through the stages of grief, and she said, okay, first thing to know is these aren't sequential. Each one is a different thing that addresses a different need, and they'll come and go, and they won't go in order. There's no end to them. They'll just be different. And I thought about something someone had said to me when I was going through a divorce. It's like a plastic ball that gets bounced, and you never know when it's going to stop bouncing. You keep thinking that the bounces, which are the hard times, are over, and then it bounces again. And it was like that combined with the stages of grief. So we talked about what each one would be, how they were already manifesting anger. How could he leave us? Grief, of course. Bargaining. Every morning, he's not dead. He's not dead. And I took to having his fire helmet on the pillow next to me, so it would be a shorter amount of time each morning that it would take for me to come to terms with he really is dead. We walked through them. We talked about them. We all grieved in our own way. And then we started trying to make plans for a funeral. And shout out to the firemen of this world, because the one thing that Brian had never really said about death is that he wanted to have a fireman's funeral. And Chief Smith and Draper Fire Department jumped on that immediately without being asked. They began planning things. And one of our kids, Brian's son, immediately said, I want to talk, which was surprising to me. He was very introverted, often very shy, and not exactly a studious type, not at that time at least. And he was so forceful about, I want to talk. He said it that day, and he never relented. He never let any of us see what he was going to talk about. But one of the first people who I saw really change was Brian's son. I'll leave his name out. He had recently graduated and moved out, still kind of finding himself. But like I said, he was so unrelenting in, I'm going to speak at my dad's funeral. And then I was going to speak, and Brian's sister, who he was very close to, were going to speak. Leading up to the funeral, there's a lot to be said, but not anything specific except that it was another huge thing of how do people treat death differently. And when it comes on so fast and so unexpected, you get to the core of a person very, very quickly. So how his parents handled it, how my dad handled it, he didn't know what to do, so he stayed in Idaho. My mom came down, but she didn't know what she was, what to do then. My sister, who had come from Oregon, just knew that she had to get water in me and keep people from trying to barge in. An unenviable job, for sure. And then closely thereafter, her husband came. Now, he was a widower himself. His first wife had died about a year into their marriage in their early 20s. And he and Brian were dear friends. And when he got there, he did the perfect thing. He just came up to me and he hugged me, and we just cried and cried and cried and cried. And I'm so sorry. I love you. I'm so sorry. And he didn't try and excuse it away. He didn't try and say, this is what's happening. Here's an answer for anything. It was just gut-wrenching pain from both of us. But we could feel it on each other, and we knew we weren't crazy, and it was somebody who understood. I said something to him afterwards. I hate it when people say, how are you doing? And he said, I know, I hate that too. And he said, life sucks. Do you want to ask me a different question? And so I used that. There may have been more profanity and variations of that, but
I think that's a really hard question for someone who's grieving. And it's also one of the most casual questions that we as Americans ask people without ever pausing to stop and hear the answer.
I know.
And it has become something that I have become fixated on in the last 5 years. It's like, why do we do that? And then I catch myself doing it.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, I don't want to say that. Like, sometimes I'll take it right back. I'm like, you know what? It's okay. You don't need to tell me how you're doing. I just really want to say hi or whatever. Sometimes I'll backpedal it a little bit. Sometimes I might say, no, I really want to know. And I'll stand there and wait to hear. But we kind of get into cultural things. I think it's a very American thing.
It's
at least a very Utah thing. That whether we're at church or at the grocery store or whatever, oh, hey, how you doing? And we keep walking.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, great. You know, and like that's just a way of greeting. Uh-huh. But it's really lost. But when you lose somebody, that question can be so painful.
When you're going through hell, what do you tell somebody?
Yeah. And also because you're like, I'm going through hell. And so if you really care, show up here.
So I'm sure you guys have both had it. And frankly, I've found myself doing it. Mm-hmm. It's such a colloquialism in our society. And so I'll find myself saying that, but I'll also immediately amend with, okay, on a 1 to 10 scale. And, you know, the 1 to 10 will depend on who I'm talking to and what's going on. But like, okay, a 1 is a dead body on the kitchen floor. A 10 is, you know, brand new baby. Where are you at in that? And because it gets them a little bit of an out to say, I'm at a 2. Mm-hmm. I'm at a 3. I think I can see a 4 today, but right now it feels like a 2. And it's just a little bit way to get more specific without being too intrusive of people who you genuinely care about and are worried about. Mm-hmm. That doesn't come down to asking too much of them. But saying I care.
Right. I like that. It's a great tip.
It's worked more times than it's not. And I've had more conversations following it than I think I would have had if I hadn't started adopting it. But again, that I give credit to my brother-in-law for that.
Yeah. Just exhausting. Thank you so much for being on today. We really appreciate you sharing your story with us. And
to each of our listeners, we hope you've also enjoyed what you've heard today and that you'll tune in for part two next week.
You can subscribe to our podcast, leave us a rating and review. It helps us move up in different apps, wherever you get your podcast. If you know someone who has a real story about real life that they're willing to share, or if you do, you can contact us by clicking on the box above Relentlessly Resilient on Facebook. Schedule a 15-minute call with me. You can also find us on Instagram at Relentlessly Resilient Podcast.
To everyone who's listening, please, whatever you do today, remember to be kind. You have no idea the struggles others are dealing with in their lives. Have a good day, everyone.